This is an ABC podcast.
On Thursday, after months of reconstruction, the Australian Museum, this country's oldest, was reopened. The New South Wales Premier did the honours.
So I'm incredibly proud to be here, incredibly pleased to see the new chapter of the museum open. And it's been an interesting time also, and I'm looking forward, although it can't be here yet, we will see Tutankhamun eventually, won't we, Kim? Fingers crossed, but it'll happen. But looking forward to really learning of the enjoyment this place will bring. And interestingly, I had the opportunity, and I'm sure many of you here have had, to see the behind-the-scenes exhibitions as well, which are just amazing. But congratulations to all involved. Congratulations to the effervescent Kim Mackay and her team, and to all of you who lead our cultural organisations, who donate generously, and who really provide the support that organisations like this need and thrive on, to provide joy, excitement, intrigue, curiosity, and learning to future generations. Thank you very much.
And we shall visit the museum shortly in this science show with more winners, a new monkey, and even an emu trying to fly. But we start with a warning, one you know about, and now it has some startling figures attached. PhD student Divya Jagadish warns that soon half the world will be short-sighted unless they put their screens aside, just for a bit. The remedy, you see, is elementary. Go outdoors for 20 minutes and look around. Divya.
The estimated projections show that by the year 2050, half of the world will have myopia or short-sightedness. This is a condition where there is difficulty to see distant objects clearly. Unlike other eye problems, myopia causes your eyeball to stretch and elongate. Now, what happens when you overstretch a balloon? It may crack or even tear. Now, your eyeball is also elastic in nature. But I'm not saying that we can fully apply the same logic of a balloon to the eyes, but the stretching phenomena due to myopia occurs especially at the back surface of the eye or the posterior surface of the eye. And if the magnitude of myopia is high, then this can lead to visual impairment and it may cause blindness in some. With the excessive use of near vision gadgets and less time spent outdoors, the onset of myopia may occur earlier in life. A higher prevalence of myopia was observed in association with intensive education system, widespread use of smartphones or electronic devices. Our research shows that younger the age of myopia onset, more the yearly increase of myopic prescription. Now, how can we intervene? For my doctoral study, we chose to investigate myopia in children, and we aim to predict the onset and the annual increase in myopic prescription in children using certain biomarkers present in the eye. The younger the age we identify a myope who's at risk of increase in their prescription, or a pre-myope, meaning someone who's at the risk of developing myopia, the earlier we can control or may even prevent the occurrence. An extensive review of literature helped us in identifying that most of the structural changes occur mainly in the posterior portion of the eye, where the nerves passes through the eyes to the brain and as well as in the different layers of the eyeball. We mapped the posterior portion of the eye that involves photoreceptors, blood vessels, etc., and correlated this with eye prescription and length in thousands of children. Some instrumentation techniques and high-level programming was used for the analysis of eye structures and functions, and our trial shows that in myopic children, there is a peculiarity in the shape of the nerve head that connects eyes and brain, and there's an irregularity in the posterior surface of the eye. Now, we all have separate fingerprints. Similarly, myopic eye nerves and microvessels are peculiar and they have separate prints than the normal eyes. Based on this, we were able to develop theoretical models to predict myopia onset and increase in existing myopic prescription. Our next step is to determine if there are other features that would strengthen this association and also to validate these models. Once we identify the children who are at risk, appropriate myopia intervention or controlling strategies may be used. Pharmaceutical strategy or combination therapies, etc., may be used. But the sensible option always is to prevent the occurrence of a disease, and in our case, myopia. As the saying goes, prevention is better than cure. One of the doable steps parents can take is encouraging children for outdoor activities on a daily basis. Spending more time outdoors has shown to have a protective effect against onset of myopia in children. Engaging children in sporting activities or playing outdoors is an established way of controlling myopia in many East Asian countries. The role of ambient light exposure plays an important role in the eye growth, and this cannot be stressed enough as it is evidenced by both animal and human studies. Research shows that spending at least 80 minutes a day outdoors may delay the onset of myopia in children. So that's it for today. Thank you so much for your time, and I hope you'll all spread the word about myopia.
Yes, spread the word and keep seeing well. Divya Jagadish is doing her PhD at the University of New South Wales. And so to the Australian Museum. I got there just before the opening and joined director Kim McKay as they were unleashing the dinosaurs to scare us once more. Building noises. Kim McKay.
Here we are.
Here we are.
Here we are in front of Tyrannosaurus Rex. This is extraordinary. So we're just uncrating the Tyrannosaurs Meet the Family exhibition, which the Australian Museum created about 7 years ago. And since it appeared here, it's been touring the world to record crowds all through North America. And it has just been in Scotland pre-COVID, and then COVID hit and it went into lockdown. These lovely beasts were all locked up. Of course, we were going to have Tutankhamun for our opening and it got locked up. So we decided to air freight Tyrannosaurs back to Australia, and there could be no better show for a local audience than this big, wonderful dinosaur show that's really telling us new things about the family of Tyrannosaurs. So people are going to love it. Those who saw it last time, their kids have grown up, so a whole bunch of new kids will come in, and it really is extraordinary. And of course, it's in our new touring exhibition hall, Robin, which is 1,000 square metres, and it means we can take really big, wonderful shows. And this space is extraordinary.
It's huge, as is T-Rex. Did it have to go into isolation in Scotland and when it came back here?
Well, we managed to do a deal to get him out of isolation. No hotel room would take him.
You've been director of the museum for how many years now?
6.5, Robin. Hasn't that gone so quickly? I'm so lucky. It's just been a fabulous time to really transform the museum. And we built that new entrance, Crystal Hall, originally, and then we built the wonderful Westpac Long Gallery with the 200 treasures of the museum. And now this complete transformation with Project Discover. The New South Wales government gave us $50 million, and then we had to supplement that with philanthropic funds, which we've successfully done, fortunately. And really, with a comparatively small budget, I hate to say $57.5 million is small, but compared to some other projects, it's small. And it really has delivered, I think, a beautiful result for not just the museum, but it's created this new civic space for Sydney. So it's incredibly exciting for us. I can't wait to welcome people back in.
Indeed. Well, 57, I mean, you buy two airports with that. It's quite extraordinary, isn't it? However, going further back, you were not a scientist as such, but you were one of the pioneers. Excuse me, is he burping? That's T-Rex. He tends to be fairly lively sometimes. Kim, you were one of the originators of Clean Up Australia with Ian Kiernan way back.
I was. I co-founded Clean Up with Ian back in 1989 when we did that first Clean Up the Harbour Day. I still say that was one of the best days of my life, which is pretty sad because it was about garbage.
Yeah.
But what was so great about it was seeing the community of Sydney respond so well to it. And then, of course, the next year we went national, and Clean Up Australia, of course, has gone on. I meet people in their 40s who participated as children. But it was really fantastic to motivate the Australian community to get out and do something about the visual pollution they saw. And of course, it did change many things with government as well over the years. Really a new awakening. Well, there's that dinosaur groaning again in the background. It was a new awakening for us all about that this pollution was having other impacts. It wasn't just the visual unsightly mess on the beach, on the tide line. That plastic pollution in our oceans was having a dramatic effect on wildlife, and that we were just producing too much waste.
And then you did things with National Geographic, at the genes we've had, and the story has become so wonderfully complex, because I'm standing here in front of you with 5% of my genes are Neanderthal, and you've probably got a couple of Denisovan genes as well, and so you can find out where people came from. But with that sort of background, which is a general one, you then became the director of the Australian Museum, and here we are on the brink. Now, the one thing I find extraordinary about this opening, and I say this having been president of the Trust way back in the 80s and beginning of the 90s, when sadly we had to have charges. Four of us voted against, but various realists decided that they have to have charges. And you have taken the charges away. Congratulations. But how did you manage?
Well, we went and talked to the state government about it and said this is a museum for all Australians and for everybody in Sydney and New South Wales, and there should be no barrier to having people come into the museum. So we've certainly got them off in the opening season up until the 30th of June, but my goal is to have them forever. And I think we will, only because I've seen grandparents, parents and kids come in together where they can learn together and be inspired. You see the little light bulbs go off in kids' eyes. And everybody should have access to that. This museum and its extraordinary collection belongs to the people of New South Wales. So there should be no barrier of entry. You've got to pay for special exhibitions like Tyrannosaurs. But of course, now there's no general entry charge. It makes that much more affordable too. So we're just hoping that the crowds will flock in, COVID safely, of course, and that people will dine here. We've got a wonderful rooftop restaurant. We've got a family cafe. And that they'll go to the shop, the beautiful new shop that we've
created. They'll be created. Too scared.
Oh, I know that. Don't you love that Rory in the background? So I'm just hoping that people will support the museum. I mean, I know now everyone is pretty anxious. We've been locked down for a long time. And they're keen to get out and take the kids and the family to something new. But this is not just for kids. This museum has something for everyone. And one of the great things is we've created the new Grand Hall upstairs. And that hall will have music in it and entertainment. So you can just wander in here on a weekend, bring a date. You'll bring some of your Neanderthal friends maybe and hang out, have a coffee, look at the exhibits. You know, just spend an hour here because you can come back anytime. And that to me is really important. From the day I got here, I said I wanted this to be a place where people could just come all the time and really enjoy what this museum has to offer. We are a world-class institution. Our science punches so far above its weight globally, as you know. Our science research is extraordinary, and that's so important. Now, of course, we're opening a new climate change exhibition upstairs too as part of the reopening.
This young man, Tim Flannery, is that his name? Is he associated with that, perhaps?
Yeah, Tim, of course, has rejoined the Australian Museum as a fellow in climate change research. And Tim spent 15 years here as head of mammalian biology and, of course, discovered so many new species at that time. And I'm so excited that one of his proteges, Professor Chris Helgen, has joined us now. Chris, of course, heading up the Australian Museum Research Institute, a wonderful mammalian biologist himself, just discovered a new monkey this week, my God, that was just published. So Chris is bringing a whole new level of science to the museum and really inspiring our team of senior scientists. Science is core to everything we do, but of course, so is First Nations culture, because we're not just a natural history museum in the traditional sense. We have a world-class cultural collection, and that comes from First Nations people here in Australia and also across the Pacific principally. And so we'll be looking very much more at learning from First Nations people. I mean, look what we can learn from land management and the bushfires. That's an easy one, but there are so many things that our First Nations people can teach us about looking after the country better and just being a custodian of the land in a better way. And for me, that is a real challenge. You know, we're a colonial institution steeped in some not very good practices in the past. You know, we were founded in 1827, so you can imagine, just not long after the colony was founded here. So we've got that baggage in our past, but now here's an opportunity for us to forge a new path for the future. We have a wonderful team of young First Nations people working here. Mid next year, we'll have a completely astonishing exhibition that they have created called Unsettled that I want everyone to come and see. It may change your understanding of white settlement of Australia. So museums should be places where there is lively discussion and debate and where we can talk about issues in a safe sort of way. And I'm just hoping that the new physical spaces we've created will be reflected in our new philosophical direction as well.
Thank you, Kim.
Thanks, Robin.
Kim McKay is the director of the Australian Museum, and she mentioned her new head of their research institute just now, and here he is. Have you really named a monkey this week?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a handsome little creature, actually.
A New South Wales monkey?
It's not from Australia, Robin.
So how did you come to name it?
It's a beautiful animal. It's from Burma, from Myanmar. And a lot of the work I've done, you know, over the last decade or two has taken me to tropical places all over the world. That includes Southeast Asia. And this is a species. It's not that no one knew about it. People knew it was there, but no one took a close enough look at it until we did just now.
And it looks like some other monkeys, but it's not directly related. Is that right?
Well, that's right. We know what genus it's in, which is a genus called Trachypithecus. So we know what neighborhood it lives in terms of its classification. But finally, it's gotten its own species name. But this thing has a shock of long gray hair. It looks like it's got white makeup around the eyes and got a very long tail. So it's a beautiful creature. It's a bit of a sad story, though, Robin. There's only about 250 individual animals in the world. And we've looked, you know, our teams in Myanmar and across the range where we expect the monkey to be found, we've looked closely. So there's only a few left.
Any in zoos?
No, there aren't any in zoos. And that's something that we'll probably have to change to make sure that the prospects of this monkey are better into the future. It's fascinating. Myanmar has many sacred sites where there may be monasteries, there may be places of pilgrimage. And for this monkey, some of the only populations are left because some of these areas are sacred to people. So Southeast Asia, a place in the world where there are so many people, there's less and less room, as we know, for the wildlife of the world. A challenging story because it's a fun discovery we have to report, but it has this sobering message. There's a message of hope, too. There are still these individual animals around, and now that we know what they are, they can be entered into the logs and the laws as well in Myanmar. We can do things to protect them.
Plenty of animals also being discovered in the other part of Southeast Asia, in Vietnam. And one of your colleagues here is going to look for frogs all the time there and doing very well and coming across small deer. It's amazing.
Yeah, well, that's right. Vietnam has been a real epicenter for species discovery for quite a few years now. It's stunning. So you're talking about Jody Rowley, who is our frog expert, and she is one of our superstars on our team here. She's finding frogs all around Australia. She's finding frogs all over Asia. Unstoppable, really. She recently had a beautiful tree frog named in her own honor. She's usually the one naming them, but one was named in her honor recently, so we've been proud to be learning about that. But yes, Vietnam, a very large species of antelope, weighing a couple hundred kilo, turned up in the 1990s. Mm. And monkeys, a species of rabbit. You don't think of rabbits in the rainforest. There's only a few, and one of them lives there in Vietnam. So these discoveries have been pretty hard and fast out of that part of the world.
Have you had many named after yourself?
A couple. And Robin, this is like the territory of, you know, dubious honors, because only 2 weeks ago I had an organism named in my honor, a genus, in fact, not just a species. You know, this is something, a point of pride. However, this creature is an intestinal parasite.
Well, in this museum, the Australian Museum, founded in 1827, upstairs, David Attenborough got presented with, I think it was a slug.
I think that's right, a semi-slug from Tasmania. So yes, you know, choose your poison. We all have something or other that maybe eventually we're lucky enough to have bear our name. But for immortality, mine will be attached to a gut parasite. It's from New Guinea rats, by the way, which are a special emphasis of mine.
Excellent. You've come from Adelaide, and you were there for a good spell. How are you enjoying settling into Sydney?
I'm loving it. I've never lived in Sydney before, but I've got a good history with this place, with this museum. I knocked on the door here as a 17 or 18-year-old kid and asked to be introduced to Tim Flannery, and marvelously, he grabbed me by the arm and pulled me behind the scenes, and we've worked together ever since. But 22 years, I guess it's been, since that moment. I've been coming and going to the museum, but this is the first time. I love it here. We're living amongst temperate remnant rainforests, New South Wales. It feels absolutely wonderful. It reminds me more of New Guinea, a place I know well, than it does of Adelaide in many ways. Fantastic.
And what are your plans for the Institute, which you're heading at the moment?
Well, I think you're going to see me working to adopt more and more new technology. I'm a traditionalist, person who describes species, works on field expeditions, you know, does all the classical stuff. But I've also been brought up as a scientist to use the very latest molecular genomic techniques. A lot of my work has drawn on the advances in ancient DNA, the other ways that we sequence genomes. So we do that well here, but you're going to see us doing it more and more and even better. That's one thing. But another emphasis will be to continue doing things we do best, which is naming species, documenting the richness of life on Earth. And, you know, as some of the older generation moves along over the years, I'll see to it that we can continue to have that expertise, that we continue to do things like expeditions in fantastic parts of the world, including places around Australia.
Awkward question. Are you possibly going to look once more at the work of Mike Archer when he was director of the museum here, trying to, if you like, resurrect possibly a frog and, who knows, maybe a Tasmanian tiger?
Well, you know, Mike and I get along very well, and we're pretty close colleagues. But the answer to that question is no, and there's good reason for it. The thylacine. What an iconic animal, emblematic of all things incredible, this wild predatory marsupial. We'd all love to see it back, right? But wishes don't mean that that is possible. So I was actually part of the team a decade or so ago that first sequenced the entire mitochondrial genome of a thylacine. More and more we've learned, you know, other teams have gone on beyond that and sequenced so much of the genetic information about the thylacine. However, I mean, think about it, Robin. You can have as much DNA base pair letter information as you want about a thylacine. You still don't really know even how many chromosomes that thing had. You don't know how its genome was organized. You don't know how you would possibly bring one back. You have to reproduce this thing. It's not just letters on the page. And so could you ever bring back an extinct animal? Something like a mammoth in theory might be possible. And one of the only reasons why is there's a living species, the Asian elephant, that's very closely related to it. So the DNA is one thing, but the reproductive biology, that's an obstacle that's almost impossible to overcome. So anyways, you're going to see me want to focus on using information from extinct species like the gastric brooding frog or like the thylacine as information we can uncover and unearth like treasure, but that more illuminates how these species declined, why they became extinct, what we can learn in terms of conservation now for other species. To me, that's the treasure of studying these genomes. Probably not the what I would have to say, in my view, is a science fiction view of bringing them back.
Congratulations and thank you.
You're welcome, Robin. Thank you.
Dr. Chris Helgen, Director of the Research Institute at the Australian Museum. And yes, the museum is open once more. The Science Show on RN, and here, and this will come as a surprise to Chris, is an animal he and the museum may not know, an emu called Henry, trying to fly.
Henry the emu wanted to fly. He'd been trying since he was two. But flap as he might, his wings were too small. He was sad and depressed. He was blue. His friends from the bush had tried helping him out. There was Wayne, his best mate from next door. Just jump from the ledge, flap your wings, you'll be right. Henry fell straight to the floor. Old Bertie the Brolga said, I've just the thing, and pulled from her shed some elastic. A launcher, she cried. We'll give you some spring. You'll go far. It'll be just fantastic. further and tighter the rubber band stretched, some dingoes had joined in to help. On my count, Bertie said, 1, 2, 3, let it rip! And Henry shot off with a yeah! The crowd gave a gasp as they witnessed the sight of an emu soaring high through the air. Henry was wrapped, he was up, he was free! Then his joy quickly turned to despair. The arc was too flat, the landing was grim, Henry's legs buckled into his chest. To make matters worse, he got 42 stings from crashing straight on an ant's nest.
Poor Henry, his adventures, once heard on The Science Show, were launched as a book this week. Henry the Flying Emu. More later. You may have noticed that it's the awards and prizes season, plus plus, mainly because so much has been crammed into the end of the year because of COVID. The Eureka's late and the New South Wales Premier's Prize has just passed. And one went to Zai Ping Guo, a distinguished professor at the fabulous Innovations Campus, University of Wollongong. Congratulations, it's a wonderful achievement.
Thanks, Robin.
What did they say about why they awarded you the New South Wales Prize?
Because of my achievement in the battery research, especially the lithium-ion batteries.
Now, we've done interviews about that before. How is your work different from the work, say, at Monash?
Very different, I would like to say. Although we're both working on lithium-ion rechargeable battery system, but we work on different electrode materials. We actually trying to improve the current commercially available electrode material, trying to boost the energy density, power density, and the safety as well.
How much can you boost it?
Depends on the material system. For the current lithium ion battery, we use modified lithium cobalt oxide to replace the current cathode material. We use the silicon-based anode, replace the graphite anode currently used in commercial lithium battery. We can boost the energy density by 30% to 50%.
But lithium obviously is the basis, possibly, for a major industry in Australia, as we've said before. Could we really take off with a bigger industry?
Lithium steel probably the best commercial rechargeable batteries available in the market so far, but we're working on other battery system as well, for instance, lithium sulfur battery. So this sort of battery system theoretically has much higher energy density, probably 10 times higher than lithium ion, but the cycle life of lithium sulfur battery is a problem. It's still not so satisfactory. We're also working on zinc ion battery. This sort of battery, they use water-based electrolyte instead of flammable organic-based electrolyte in current lithium-ion battery. So by using this zinc-ion battery, we can achieve better safety, more environment-friendly, and also price lower compared to lithium-ion battery.
And it won't burst into flames?
No, because it uses water-based electrolyte. It's non-flammable, so it's intrinsically safe.
In your wildest dreams, and I know scientists hate this question, if you really come off and manage to have these vast improvements, can you see, for instance, cars, electric cars going so much further? Can you see household batteries improving so that you're virtually independent of the grid and so on?
Sure, because if the energy density increase, for instance, by using our modified anode cathode in the lithium battery, we can boost the energy density. So by using those batteries, the driving range for the electric cars potentially can achieve like 800 kilometers or even 1,000 kilometers.
And could you charge it quickly?
Yes, that's our target, trying to improve the power density. That means we can charge it in 10 minutes, fully charge the battery in 10 minutes. Yeah, theoretically we can achieve that. And the small cell scale battery, we can achieve 10 minutes charge as well. But the problem is if we enlarge to large scale production after that, what's going to happen? There's still a lot of engineering problem we've got to face.
Yeah. When you've solved it, perhaps we may even manufacture the batteries here in Australia, do you think?
I hope so, yeah. Australia has a lot of mining companies. Those companies, they have lithium mining, or those elements are quite rich. But unfortunately, there's no large battery manufacturer in Australia. We are working towards trying to attract attention from different companies. Hopefully they can invest. Currently, I actually collaborate with a startup company called Sikona Battery Technology. trying to establish a pilot production line here, large scale produce our silicon-based anode material for lithium-ion battery. Hopefully it can be used in commercial lithium-ion battery in the future.
So we have the lithium, we have the brain power, which you represent, and we have the new ideas that could make the battery so much more powerful. If only, my final question is a personal one. Mm-hmm. A distinguished professor, mm-hmm. How do you become a distinguished professor? Now you're an even more distinguished professor, aren't you?
I hope so. I guess university has a selection criteria for the distinguished professor.
Congratulations and thank you.
Thank you, Robin. Thanks.
Such potential. Distinguished Professor Xiaoping Guo at the University of Wollongong. Another New South Wales Premier's winner is also at Wollongong, whose gigantic microscope reveals 3D pictures of minute proteins to help save your life.
I'm Antoine Van Ogen. I'm a distinguished professor here at the University of Wollongong and the director of our brand new Molecular Life Sciences Institute, Molecular Horizons.
What a title. And congratulations, the New South Wales Premier's Award.
Thank you. It was a very pleasant surprise and a beautiful event at Government House.
And where are we standing now at the University of Wollongong?
We're currently standing in a really quiet room. And we have here in front of us the 4 meter tall cryo electron microscope. It's called a Titan Cryos. And one of the amazing things that it does is that it allows us to look at individual protein molecules and visualize all the tiny nooks and crannies that make up that protein. And that's really important for us to understand when we start to think about drug development and new therapies that physically will interact with those proteins that are important in disease.
And you say cryo, how cold is it in there?
This is a liquid nitrogen temperature, so that's roughly 80 kelvins, 80 degrees above absolute zero, which in normal plain English is roughly minus 200 degrees C.
That is very, very cold indeed. It's interesting that you say Kelvin. You don't say degrees Kelvin. That's a mistake, isn't it?
That's correct. I've had many people around me who've corrected that mistake out of me.
Now, I was there at the launch when you got the lovely cheque in Parliament House in Canberra from the then Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull. Has the promise been realised?
We're going extremely well. We did receive Malcolm Turnbull's blessing. We didn't receive a cheque, though. This has been a University of Wollongong internal investment, us recognising the opportunity of establishing a high-quality research institute and being able to do it quickly by using an internal investment. And now we're doing wonderful things. The building is ready and we are fully active in our research. And now, of course, is the time to leverage that and getting more external funding. So that's maybe where the government checks will come in soon. What we've done over the last few years, we've built a beautiful building. We have a couple of microscopes that are now fully up and running, visualizing individual protein structures and really understanding how these machineries of life at the smallest nanoscale, how they work and how they play a role in disease. We've established a center here in Wollongong that will allow not just Wollongong researchers, but researchers from the country and overseas even to come in and to study their biological system, their disease of interest. We create an image on a camera, but instead of using light particles, we use electrons. And the big difference has to do with the wavelength of the particles that you use. Electrons allow you to see much smaller detail than light.
Can we go outside for a second and have a look at one of those proteins? We're going outside and here on a screen is the image of, oh God, a cluster of molecules, a cluster of atoms going round. Describe it, would you?
So what we're looking at here is the structure of a protein called aldolase, and it's a quite complicated protein that plays a really important part in your metabolism in breaking down of sugars and using those sugars for fuel for your cells in your body. And what we see here rotating in front of us on this computer screen in 3D is the actual high-resolution structure as we get it off the microscopes. There's a lot of steps in between putting a sample in there and then getting a beautiful structure such as this one. But what it really does, the machine takes many, many snapshots of individual proteins, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of individual images, And they're all extremely noisy and blurry. You hardly see anything. But what the computer then does is they starts to average them on top of one another. And using 100,000 images of the one protein, it then can reconstruct a three-dimensional image of how that protein, on average, looks like.
How many atoms in that protein do you think?
You're putting me on the spot here. So
squillions and squillions. But the point is, what I'm looking at is there's no distinctive shape there. It's a cluster. But the shape I'm looking at is the basis for its activity, for its actions.
Absolutely. So the nooks and crannies and the little bobs and bits that you see here sticking out from the protein surface, essentially each corresponds to groups of atoms that each play really important functional roles in how the protein works. Compare it to your car. If you open the bonnet, at least for me, I really don't know anything about what's happening under the bonnet of my car, but you see the engine, you see all kinds of bits and bobs sticking out, and they somehow must be important for the functioning of my car. It's the same for the proteins. And if you now want to design, as a chemist, if you want to design a molecule that can in a very specific way interact with the protein and, for example, make it stop doing things that in a disease could have been one of the things that go wrong, then you really need to understand how these bits and bobs look like.
It's interesting, isn't it? We think of DNA. We know about the shape, the structure of DNA. And if I may do a leap, we had on the Science Show a couple of weeks ago, the story of the fact that 100 years ago, someone called Rosalind Franklin was born. She, whose name kind of slipped from the celebration of the discovery of the structure of DNA, because she died, but she lives on as a legend. And she went on to do work on this very thing, to work on the structure of these sorts of molecules, not least in the search of viruses. Who knows, like COVID, that would have been quite useful, wouldn't it? So knowing the structure of something that might attack the COVID virus, that's what you're about.
Absolutely. So what we're trying to do is, so the motto is really seeing is believing. And this is, I think, a useful motto in life in general, but in molecular life sciences, it's a really important one. Seeing is believing. So what we're trying to do is use all these microscopes to see what kinds of structures we have, because that's really the starting point to finding new cures and therapies for pretty much everything that can go wrong in our body, including infection by SARS-CoV-2 and giving us COVID.
Well, as I say, celebrating your award, now I was always impressed that you left Harvard to come to Wollongong. No regrets?
Absolutely not. I can tell you that the beaches in Wollongong are much better than the ones next to Boston. Wollongong is a fantastic place to live, but also a fantastic academic environment to be in. It's a very young university, only 40 plus years old, and there's an incredible excitement and enthusiasm to do really big, bold things. And I think that the institute we established with the beautiful building that we have, that we're standing in right now, that's one of these big, bold ideas. And it's super exciting to be part of that.
Final question, talking about the building. What about the concrete floor?
So this building has been really designed from the bottom up to accommodate these highly sensitive microscopes. The floor the microscopes are standing on are thick, 1 meter thick concrete slabs, and they're physically not connected to the rest of the building. So they're really disconnected, and any vibration that comes into the building because of wind or whatever will not propagate through to the floor the microscope is standing on. These microscopes are so sensitive that if you wouldn't do that, it would actually pick up the sounds of the crashing waves on the beach a few kilometers away, and that would destroy your measurements. So the vibrational decoupling, as we call it, is really important. Another thing that's really cool about the building is that we also need decoupling from electromagnetic interference. And the building is built up from concrete that does not have the usual steel reinforcement structure. Instead, the concrete has glass fiber reinforcement. And this is the largest glass fiber concrete reinforced structure on the planet, I believe. It's quite an impressive work of construction and design.
Very exciting. Congratulations again, and thank you.
Thank you.
Our second Premier's winner, Professor Antoine van Oijen at the University of Wollongong. And yes, the beaches are better than Harvard's. Poor America. J. Joseph Banks has featured large this year, the aristo on Cook's voyage, one rather diminished by this year's mega stories. Banks was a naughty man, as you may have heard on LNL Late Night Live with Philip a few days ago. But he was also a great entrepreneur who found the artists who first brought pictures of our plants and animals in Australia to an astounded world, names like Sydney Parkinson. Here, Dr. David Mabberley, a former director of the Royal Botanic Garden Sydney, tells the tale.
Joseph Banks, the only son of a rich country landowner, had such a passion for botany that as an undergraduate at Christchurch, Oxford, he brought in a botany lecturer from Cambridge. In January 1767, he returned from an expedition to North America and spent much of the rest of the year as a dilettante naturalist and antiquarian, besides setting up house in London. The furnishing for that house included work by an upholsterer, Stanfield Parkinson, whose brother Sidney was employed by Banks to draw American animal specimens. Sidney Parkinson was from a Scottish Quaker family, and although apprenticed to a wool draper, may also have been trained in natural history illustration. Some of his early floral compositions were exhibited in London the year he probably moved there to be engaged by the Quaker nurseryman James Lee to teach Lee's teenage daughter flower drawing. In Lee's network was another Quaker, Dr. John Fothergill, a very successful physician and naturalist at Upton Park in North London, which, according to Banks, was to become second only to Kew Gardens. Fothergill built greenhouses and stovehouses some 80 metres long. He supported plant collectors overseas and amassed a collection of some 3,400 species from warm countries. As the more interesting plants flowered, he had them painted. This whole enterprise, living collections, artists and plant collectors, had an enormous effect on Banks and seems to have been one of the spurs to exotic travel, and eventually he's using it as a model for Kew and putting Kew to use as an imperial clearinghouse for economic plants and setting the form of all botanic gardens ever since. The Royal Society, of which Banks was a fellow, recommended that the government send a ship to observe the transit of Venus across the Sun in the Pacific, an observation to enable the calculation of the distance from the Earth to the Sun, critical in navigation. The Society stressed that several of the great powers in Europe, particularly the French, Spanish, Danes and Swedes, are making the proper dispositions for the observation thereof. But this was one of several European voyages to the Pacific during a period of tension between Britain and France, including France's support for the Americans in the American Revolutionary War, War of Independence, and France's push into the Pacific, especially the King's 1766 orders to take possession of lands there, including Australia. Banks arranged that he should be a supernumerary, concentrating on natural history, and pay his own way. So persuasive was he that Endeavour, under James Cook, was eventually to have a party of 9 civilians, including Sidney Parkinson and 2 black servants, headed by Banks, as well as Banks's greyhound. Parkinson was to draw natural history specimens, Alexander Buckham the scenery and human portraits. The total baggage and equipment of Banks's team weighed perhaps some 20 tons. Fothergill thoughtfully provided Cook's Endeavour with apples that kept well for over a year. During the voyage, Parkinson made pencil sketches and added notes on colours, with part of the drawing finished in watercolour. In Tahiti, where they anchored on 10th of April 1769, the artist Alexander Buchan died of epilepsy, so that Parkinson had to take on his duties too. At the beginning, he was able to complete some watercolours, but in Australia he could not keep up with the number of subjects to draw. With observations of the transit completed, Cook then set off southwards to seek the southern continent, as instructed, with the consent of the natives to take possession of convenient situations in the country in the name of the King of Great Britain, or, if you find the country uninhabited, take possession for His Majesty by setting up proper marks and inscriptions as first discoverers and possessors. Cook reached 40 degrees south, and as he had expected, found no continent. So, following his instructions, he made for New Zealand. With weather against him, Cook then changed course allowing him to investigate the east coast of New Holland of earlier maps. Though it has been posited that his oral instructions have been to do just that all along, as has been convincingly argued by Margaret Cameron Ash, Cook later concealing much of what he had found. They sailed north, their first landfall being on the land of the Dharawal people, today's Kurnell. Parkinson wrote, "The country is very level and fertile, the soil a kind of grey sand, and the climate mild. And though it was the beginning of winter when we arrived, everything seemed in perfection, for the number of curious plants we met with on shore, we called the bay Botany Bay." Banks's team made specimens of 132 plant species, the first scientific collection of the Australian flora. Parkinson made drawings of some 84. Considering the time of year, with rather little in flower, it was remarkably comprehensive. Then, on 11th of June, calamitously, Endeavour struck the Great Barrier Reef. She was got off the coral and moved into the river now bearing her name, beached and repaired. Parkinson sketched 141 species, including the first European image of a kangaroo. But by the 28th of July, Banks had had enough. Shortly afterwards, the weather did indeed become favourable, and picking her way through the reef, Endeavour pushed north. By October, the expedition had reached Java, where Parkinson drew 74 species, but the company began to succumb to the diseases prevalent there. The voyage home saw the deaths of 22 of the company, including Parkinson, probably from a combination of malaria and dysentery. Of the 94 in the company that had set out with Cook, only 41 were to return alive to England, and of Banks's original 9, just 4. Of Parkinson's work, there were 18 volumes of plant drawings, with 269 finished by him, 673 unfinished. He also made 268 of the 298 surviving animal drawings. Parkinson's brother Stanfield wanted to publish an account based on his dead brother's manuscripts and drawings. Banks lent the drawings and other papers to Stanfield, who promptly had them copied. Banks had an injunction issued such that Stanfield's publication would have to be delayed until after the appearance of the official account of the voyage to be brought out. But once that had been published, the injunction to prevent Parkinson printing Sydney's was lifted. So a month later, Parkinson's Journal of a Voyage to the South Seas appeared with some of Sydney's drawings. But Stanfield was to be declared insane and die in an asylum shortly after publication of his brother's work. As early as November 1771, Banks was said to have put aside £10,000, getting on for $4 million Australian dollars in today's money, to publish the results of the voyage. He had 753 plant drawings engraved, and there would have been no impediment to realising his enormous investment, but his income from wool and other agricultural interests during a slump following the American War of Independence was falling, and his constrained resources are generally held to be the reason for his not completing the project in which he had invested so much. But was there something more profound he had by then realised? Had he by now an eye to something better? As the art scholar Wilfred Blunt has written, "The fact remains that to place a Ferdinand Bauer beside a Parkinson is to be compelled immediately to admit that we are contrasting the work of a genius with that of a very competent and conscientious craftsman." As an artist, Parkinson, nor any of those who complete his unfinished task, were in the same class. Although Parkinson's work was infinitely superior to any earlier illustrations of Australian plants, with the work of Ferdinand Bauer a few years later was to come the highest pinnacle of botanical art to be achieved before modern times. Only at the turn of the 20th century, 130 years after they had been executed, were Parkinson's drawings published. The Natural History Museum in London issued a selection of 331 Australian drawings. It had been intended to include New Zealand and possibly other plants, but this project too was abandoned. Only with the publication of Banks's Florilegium as hand-coloured unbound engravings without commentary in the late 1980s were all of Parkinson's engraved drawings published, albeit in a very exclusive way. They were the selection of the finest coloured images in a book, where many of them at last made truly accessible just over 2 years ago.
David Mabberley has written some glorious works on botany, including Joseph Banks' Florilegium, which should be available once more in a few weeks. More from him next week in The Science Show. But one creature not illustrated by Sidney Parkinson, nor any other on Banks's voyage, was Henry the Flying Emu. This is where we left him.
And so it continued the unlikely plight of a flightless bird trying to fly. Henry cracked 7 ribs, broke 2 wing bones, 3 toes in his unfortunate attempts at the sky. He tried flying like gliders high up in the trees to succeed with his uppermost wish. He trained with galahs and with blowflies and bees. He even swam with flying fish. Then one morning, Henry stopped with a sob. "It's over," he cried. "I'm done. Flying emus? I'm kidding myself. I'm a joke." And blindly left home at a run. Henry went west over hills, dunes and swamp, sprinting for miles in the sun, through forest and grassland, past bare rocky plains, till he collapsed beneath the tall, gnarly gum. It was cold when he woke, with a pain in his side. The darkness was falling in thick. Then a cough made him jump. Henry froze. What was that? And he felt his side jabbed by a stick. "Follow me," croaked a voice with a high little cackle. The stick pushed Henry to his feet. Then Henry jumped up as he looked in the eyes of a face he never thought he would meet. Wallagoot Jean was feared through the bush. She'd white hair that reached to her knees. Missing an eye and one arm, rumoured eaten, was hobbling off into the trees. Jean, it was said, spoke 6 different languages and was 113 years old. She wore a green scarf and a hat built from leaves and made strange potions that she sometimes sold. Jean lit huge fires throughout the bush and yelled loud to scare away strangers. Most people taught kids to keep far away, for to see her usually meant danger. Henry trailed Jean to a rock overhang where a fire was giving off light. Outside, some rain started splashing the ground and 2 thunderclaps cracked through the night. Without any words, Jean put on the billy and placed 1 more log on the fire. Henry was afraid to make a sound as he watched the flames dance and the sparks spiral higher. Then Jean barked at Henry, "What you doing, young fella?" as Henry hid far out of sight. "You either get out of here or you sit on this log and you tell Jean why you're out here at night." Jean raised the billy and poured Henry tea. The coals of the fire were glowing. "Can't fly," Henry said, and blinked out a tear. The strain in his voice was showing. "My wings are too small. It's been like that from birth. I'm a flightless bird trying to fly. All my life, I've had to live stuck on the ground, but my wings want to reach for the sky." Wallagoot Jean said nothing at first, drinking tea in the red firelight. Outside the cave, a rainstorm had started, and lightning flashed all through the night. "Catching your dreams is not simple," Jean then spoke. "But to get them, quickly you'll find that to take your first step to reach for the stars, first you must fly with your mind."
A delightful book for Christmas, Henry the Flying Emu by Neeraj Lal and Adam Carruthers, published last week. Next week in The Science Show, the new museum in Western Australia opened this week, and a possible bipedal ancestor of ours, 11 million years old. Production by David Fisher. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.